that. Actually, let me just say one more thing about the subject of yesterday's lecture. So let me tell you how this conductance of one-dimensional open and closed channels is observed in the experiment. Okay, so that's going to be quick. So one very common realization is the following. Okay, so physical realization of of 1D transport. So essentially, the idea is to start with a two-dimensional electron system, right? So it's some 2D electron gas, which people know how to make in various semiconducting structures. Usually it's based on gallium arsenide. Okay, and then the idea is to essentially pattern gates on top of this electron gas and effectively make a constriction. Okay, effectively make a constriction which would be one dimensional. So how does it work? So imagine that we pattern large metallic gates on top of that, which have some distance between them. And so now let's apply, right, so this is our 2D electron gas, and these are gates. And let's now apply some potential to these gates. Okay? So what is this gonna do? This is gonna induce surface charges here, and it's gonna create electric field. Okay, so effectively our 2D electrons would experience some electrostatic potential. What would it look like? So you know that the field lines would look something like that, right? So they have to be perpendicular to the surface of the metal, right? So they go something like that, and then from the symmetry on the line separating the two gates, they would look like that. Okay, so it would be something like that. What is this point? So you see that in the y direction, potential on this point is minimum. Okay, but in the x direction, because electric field lines go away from this point, it is maximum. Okay, so which means that this point is essentially a saddle point. Okay, so the electrostatic potential near the this point, which I will choose to be the origin, would look, so it would be just some constant minus right, so in the x direction this point has maximum potential, and in the y direction it has minimum potential, right? So I chose such notation so that this omegas would correspond to the frequency of the states created by such potentials. All right. So now, effectively, in the y direction, we are expecting just to see the oscillator levels, right? So gates are confining, so transverse motion would be quantized with the energies given by the usual oscillator levels. Okay, but in the x direction, clearly your potential looks like that. Right, so let me just plot V of only the part of the potential which depends on the x coordinate. And this looks like an inverted parabola. So you know that sufficiently far away, you would always have propagating states, right? And then they can scatter somehow on this potential. So some of them would get transmitted, some of them would get reflected. If you still remember quantum mechanics, maybe you've seen that in fact scattering on this inverted parabola is is in fact an exactly solvable problem. Okay, so, and if you're curious how it's solved, you can look it up in the third volume of Landau and Lifshitz. Okay, so here let me just use the result from there. So the transmission coefficient of the nth mode turns out to be given by the following very simple formula, where epsilon n effectively tells you the energy of your state relative to the position of the parabola. Okay, so it would be 2e being the energy of your state or the chemical potential minus V naught, okay, and minus the transverse energy, because all the transverse quantization does, it pushes your energy by some amount, right, by this amount, exactly. Okay. So now let's think about the behavior of the conductance of the of a single nth channel. Okay, and let's plot it. So let's plot Tn as a function of this difference E minus V naught divided by H omega X. And why do we plot it as a function of this difference? Because in the experiment, this is exactly the quantity that you can vary. Right, you can change the overall potential, and effectively you would lift or lower your inverted parabola. So what does this formula look like? So if this parameter epsilon n is very small and negative, okay, such that effectively it means that energy of the incoming wave is low. Right, so you're somewhere here. Then of course this formula gives you zero. Right, so which means that if the barrier is strong enough, everything gets reflected. Now, if epsilon n becomes much greater than one, right, then you can neglect this, and then you get full transmission. Right, so everything. If the energy is above the barrier, then okay, you don't care about it. You just adiabatically pass through without being reflected. And crossover between these two limiting cases happens essentially, width of this is determined by this frequency omega x, right? So you get that behavior of the transmission coefficient, which looks like this, right? And it is exactly half when this thing here equals to zero. So effectively it's h omega y n plus a half divided by h omega x. Okay? Now, of course, when you measure the conductance, you have to sum, you're coupling to all the channels, and you have to sum over them, right? So the conductance of your structure is given by e squared over h sum tn. And this is formula which we derived yesterday, right? So effectively what you need to do, you need to plot many such steps for each channel, right? So for the previous channel, it will be something like that, right? And for the next channel, it will be something like that, and so on, right? So there is infinite number of them, and when you add them all up, right, so you get the total conductance, which would have a form of the staircase. Okay. So you get steps effectively, right? In when the chemical potential is such that the nth mode is fully transmitting, but the n plus first one is fully reflecting, then you get a conductance which is effectively n, right, times e squared over h. Right, so you and this conductance quantization has been observed beautifully in the experiment. Okay, in many different situations. So In principle, it could give you a way to measure value of squared over h. Except, turns out there is another system where you can measure this ratio much, much more precisely, which is quantum Hall effect, and we will get to that. So now, of course, one important condition for having these quantization steps is that these steps are space sufficiently far, because if you had a situation where steps were very smooth, right, they would start overlapping, and then you would just get slowly it will wash out, and you would just get something like that. So this condition tells you that the distance between the steps must be much greater than their width, right? And this translates, you can check into simple condition that omega y must be much greater than omega x. Okay, so this means that the confinement in the y direction should be tighter, right, than the behavior of this inverted parabola in the x direction. Is it clear how this system works? So any questions about it? Do you guys have a question? No? Okay. Uh-huh. All right, so then let's go to the main topic of today's lecture, which is gonna be graphene. So what is graphene? Graphene is one of the very few truly two-dimensional materials. Okay, so it's a 2D material. It is really just one atom thick, right? So and here feel the difference with the example of two D electron gas in the semiconductors, where the reduced dimensionality is only effective, right? And in fact the electron gas lives inside some bigger 3D semiconducting structure. Okay, so this material is not like that, right? It's really really two dimensional. Okay, so what is also cool about graphene is that it was discovered quite recently, only in 2004. Okay, and effectively it looks very simple. It's just an array of carbon atoms which are arranged in a honeycomb lattice. Right, so it's just a sheet of carbon atoms, which looks like that. It really turned out to be quite an interesting material, and there were many applications that came after the discovery, and a lot of interesting physics. And this is part of the reason why the people who discovered it got Nobel Prize only 6 years after they obtained it. Understand why this material is interesting, let's look at the band structure, right? So let's start with electronic properties. So underlying chemistry is quite simple. So essentially you have, so let me plot sort of a top view of it. What holds the carbon atoms together is the sp2 bonds, right? So each carbon is bound to each neighbor by an sp2 bond. So total there are three of them. Right, so that's what holds the whole structure together. In addition, there are pz orbitals which are sticking out of the plane. Okay, these orbitals have have one electron per orbital and they're weakly overlapping, right? So they're actually the ones which are responsible for the electronic properties, right? And we will be interested in finding the band which corresponds to electrons moving in this PZ orbitals. So let's consider a simple approximation, which actually turns out to be a very good one. So let's just assume that the electron can hop between the nearest orbitals, and this is all there is to it, right? So let's assume nearest neighbor tight binding model. Now, important thing about this lattice is that there are two electrons per unit, two sites per unit cell, right? So you can see, for example, that if you want to see how the lattice is how the lattice repeats itself, you need to take unit cell which looks like that, right? And then the whole thing becomes repeats periodically with the primitive vectors. Let's say you could choose this one and this one, right? So you can see that the whole thing can be shifted this way or this way and so on, right? So in fact, this the Bravais lattice corresponding to the honeycomb lattice is triangular, but there are two atoms, two sites per unit cell. Okay, so and let's call the different types of sites A and B. So let's call this site A and this site B, right? So then we can repeat it. So let's say this site would be A, this side would be B, this would be B, A, and so on. So it repeats itself. Now the tight binding model, which describe it, would look like that. So it would be the hopping matrix element between the two orbitals. Then you need to sum over all nearest neighbors, right? So the brackets mean that you only take the nearest neighbors, and then you take AI BJ plus the conjugate. And here the A's would create electrons on the A sides, and B's would create electrons on the B sides. So we can go to the Fourier space, right, and simply say that okay, that AI can be written as a sum over k space states Ri, so where Ri is simply the position of this atom, okay, and Bi sum over Bk Ik Ri plus the vector which connects the B side with the A side in the same unit cell. Okay, so this vector, should let me put it in color. So right, this vector I will call E1. Mm-hmm. And then for later use we will need also the vectors connecting A to its other two nearest neighbors, right? So it's E1, E2, E3. Mm-hmm. So once we go to the K space, you can very easily check that this Hamiltonian becomes diagonal in the K index, but not yet in the sublattice index, right? So you can write it like that. So it's going to be sum over K, AK prime, BK prime, HK, AK, BK, right? Where HK is going to be a matrix because you can see, right? So it's going to be a two by two matrix. So on the diagonal, it would have zeros because diagonal terms correspond to hoppings from A to A side. Right, so it must be zero, and then off diagonal we would have the hoppings between the A and B sides, which would look like that, as you can check. So where T of K is simply T times e to the I K E1 to the ik e2 to the ik e3. Okay, so you just need to take the exponentials of the scalar products of the wave vector and the vector connecting a size to its nearest neighbors. So now, yeah. Right, right, because it has to be Hermitian, right? Mm-hmm. So from this Hamiltonian, we can find the energy dispersion right away, right? So you can see that there are two bands, which are given by the just the absolute value of this T of k, okay, and this is already informative. It tells you that the band structure is particle hole symmetric. Turns out to be even more interesting is that in the brilliant zone there are points where energy is zero. Okay, so let's try to see that. So as you will see in a second, these points can be chosen to lie on the x-axis, right? So let's go to the k-space. And let's look at the value of t along this line, right? So t of kx zero. And another thing I will need is the distance between the a and b sides, which I'm going to call a. Okay, so. E to the I k x e one x gives you one, right? Because e one is directed along y axis, right? So this is just one. Then you would get e to the I k one e to the I k x e two x plus e to the I k x e3x. Okay. Now these guys give you what? So they would give you. So remember, e to x was this vector, right? So it has a scalar product. So this whole thing is gonna be cosine. This projection is square root 3 over 2a times kx. Okay? So now you can see right away that when this cosine equals minus a half, so let's call the point where it happens kx, where k is capital, then t would vanish, right? And you would get a node in the energy dispersion. So this gives you very easily that kx equals, so this whole thing should be 2 pi over 3, right? So it gives you 4 pi 3 square root 3a, okay? So we just found that if you're here, right, or it could be the negative, could be the negative half axis, then the energy is zero, and turns out that these points lie exactly at the corners of the brilliant zone, right? So in this case, for the triangular lattice, brilliant zone is has a form of a hexagon, right? And this is brilliant zone. At the corners, you find zeros of the energy dispersion. Now, if you really just go ahead and plot this dispersion, you would also discover that the energy vanishes at all the other corners of the brilliant zone, which is not surprising because there is rotational symmetry, right? But this is not relevant because in fact, out of the six corners, only two of them are not equivalent. Okay, so they fall into the groups of three, which are so inside each group, they're all related by the reciprocal lattice vectors, right? So for example, you would find that this is reciprocal lattice vector and this is reciprocal lattice vector. So these three points are in fact the same, and so are these three points. So it's enough to consider just two of them. So we found these zeros, and this is actually this is crucial for the electronic properties because naturally there is one electron per site, so which tells you that the chemical potential is going to be at zero due to the particle hole symmetry. Okay, so this the energy vanishes where it matters. So we are guaranteed that the low energy excitations would live near these nodes. Okay, if we don't dope graphene too much. So as a next step, let's find the dispersion of the quasi particles near these nodes. So let's find dispersion. So in the vicinity of the nodes. We would be interested in only region which is close to this point, so it will be sufficient for us to expand T of K, right? So to consider K, which is, let's say, Kx plus delta Kx and delta Ky, and then we can expand T of K in the small differences. Okay, so, and then once you do that, you find that it's sufficient to go to just the linear order, and you find that T of K looks like that. So it's 3/2 Ta times minus delta Kx plus I delta Ky. Okay, so let me introduce new notation and say that because this must have dimension of velocity, right? So I'm gonna call it Fermi velocity. And so, and if you substitute the numbers, you find that the Fermi velocity is roughly 10 to the 6 meters per second. Okay, so then our effective 2x2 Hamiltonian HK takes the following form. So it's HVF. And this is near the point plus K, right? So because I was expanding, around this point, right? So you have 0, 0 minus delta Kx plus I delta Ky. And here you have just the conjugate minus delta Kx minus I delta Ky. Right, so it's convenient to write it in terms of Pauli matrices minus. Okay, and which implies that the energy dispersion near the nodes would be linear, in fact. Square root x squared plus delta k y squared. Right. So if you plot the dispersion near this point, you would find that it looks like that. So it's just a cone, a conical dispersion. And same thing happens near the other point, of course, because they're actually related by symmetry, right? They're related by the reflection symmetry. This is quite a nice result. It tells you that the low energy excitations are particles which look nothing like usual massive electrons, right? So they have linear dispersion, they have a node, so they're in fact two species of Weyl fermions, okay, and this has very interesting implications for the, let's say, for the transport properties of graphene. So now one thing to address before we continue is remember we've derived this band structure under an approximation, right? So we assume that there is only nearest neighbor hopping. So you can ask if I take some more realistic band structure, if I take second, third nearest neighbor hopping, would it kill these Dirac points? Are they robust? And the answer is that yes, they are quite robust, you can first of all, you can see that Dirac points would not care about the hoppings between AA sites and BB sites effectively, because all that's gonna do, it's gonna introduce some function here, let's call it g of k, and the same function here, g of k. What is important that as long as the two sublattices are symmetric, these two functions will be exactly the same, right? Which means that your effective Hamiltonian near this k points would look like that. So it would be g of k times unit matrix plus delta k minus delta k x sigma x plus delta k y times sigma y. You see that all this does is it's effectively introduces some chemical potential. So it would shift the positions of your Dirac points, but it would not remove them. And you can also check that taking let's say hoppings between further away A and B sites, let's say if you introduce hoppings between this site and this site, also does not kill the Dirac points. Now you can notice, however, that this argument uses the symmetry between the A and B points essentially, right? So if you let me break this symmetry, then Dirac points can be gone, because this way you can open up a band gap, and you can also see it quite easily. So let's imagine, for example, that we introduced staggered potential, just simple on-site potential, which is different on the A and B sides. So let's say we have minus epsilon B equals M. Okay, this means that I should simply put M for the A sides and minus M for the B sides. And since this is the on-site energy, there is no dependency on K. Now you see that this actually makes a lot of difference, because then my HK becomes M sigma Z times plus HVF delta KX sigma X plus delta KY sigma Y, and dispersion, which corresponds to this guy, is square root of M squared plus HVF squared delta K X squared plus delta K Y squared. Okay, so this means that I went from linear, from the conical dispersion to the dispersion which looks like that and has a gap which is 2M. Okay, so but of course in real life carbon atoms are pretty much the same. So this term is absent, right? So that's why in graphene you end up with the robust Dirac points. So now let's discuss some implications for the transport properties. And there are in fact lots of implications, and lots of properties are different, but today let's consider two simple but very important ones. So we will consider first we will see that the fact that we are dealing with the Dirac-like particles implies that they have Berry phase. And this shows up in all the interference effects. So for example, we will show that because of this Berry phase, our argument for the weak localization changes completely. And in fact, instead of weak localization, you would get weak anti-localization. Right, so we'll see it in a second. And the second property we will study is how these particles get transmitted through the barriers. Right, so, and you will see that this behavior is quite different from the usual non-relativistic electrons. But before we start, actually, let me ask you. So, how many of you know what Beres phase is? Mm-hmm. So, how many of you know that spin 1/2 has a non-trivial Beres phase? Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. Okay, but I think it's good if I give you a brief reminder about Beres phase. And I mean, right. But the concept is a lot more general, so it's maybe worth reviewing it. Okay, so let me, because you will see that this is this Beres phase shows up in lots of completely different systems. So let's forget about graphene for a second, and let's consider very general quantum system with the spectrum of states, which I will call N. And let's assume that we are very slowly changing the Hamiltonian of the system in time, such that some parameters R which describe it change as a function of time. Okay, so for example, it could be in the simple example with spin, it could be a spin, and you could have magnetic field, and you can slowly change it. Right. So in this case, R would be the angles of the magnetic field, right? So it would be two angles. Now we have, of course, adiabatic theorem, which tells us that if the solution is slow, right, then we are bound to stay in the eigenstate of the new Hamiltonian, right? Now, important thing here is that the phase of the wave function can change, right? So in fact, if I want to find the evolution of my wave function under the change of Hamiltonian starting from some eigenstate, right? Very generally, I can write that psi, it would be some phase. So, and let me separate the phase into two parts. So first of all, there is this part gamma n, which will become non-trivial Beres phase, and then there is the trivial dynamical phase, which is just given by the integral of your energy under this evolution. Right. So. Right. So epsilon n as a function of r is the energy of the state for the Hamiltonian at time t. Okay. So, and then of course it should be. It's only a phase, so otherwise the state looks the same as the eigenstate. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now let's try to find this phase gamma. And for that purpose, we can write the time dependent Schrödinger equation. Right, should be equal to h psi n of t. Okay, so I can take put the Brass state, which is n of r of t. Okay, so then the advantage would be that I can act with h to the left, and simply it will simply give me energy, right? So then what do I get? So I get that n r of t. Now let's look at this derivative, right? It will have effectively it will have three terms, right? I can take the derivative of this phase, of this one, and this one. Right, so there would be h d gamma n dt. Right, then there is my overall phase. N r of t. This is first term on the left, right? Then there is a second term, which would just give me the energy, right? Instant energy at time t times da 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 plus. There would be another term which looks like that, so which is n r of t, the whole phase, right? The I gamma n e times minus I over h integral, and then I can act with ddt to this state, to this state, right? So it will be ddt n r of t. And on the right, I simply have, so I can act with h on this brass state, right? And then I will get epsilon n of t, and the norm is going to be one, right? So then this one exactly cancels out this one, and this tells me that these two terms must be equal. You can get rid of this trivial phase here because it's just a number, right? And you can also get rid of this one. Then by relating these two terms, you would get a condition on gamma n. Okay, so you would get that effectively that d gamma n dt must be proportional to n r of t d dt n r of t. Okay? So then you can integrate this out and you'll get that gamma n. So first of all, you can rewrite it as a derivative of derivative with respect to r, right? And then you can integrate it out just over the path you are taking in the r space. So it would be dr. So r is generally a vector. And here I introduce notation that a n of r is just this object. So it's n of r d dr n of r. So it tells you effectively by how much your eigenstates change when you change your Hamiltonian in this space of parameters r. So you can easily imagine it being non-trivial if you are dealing with vectors, right? If you are dealing, for example, with spin, right? So mm-hmm. All right. So and now, of course, you can guess that there is some freedom in choosing the phase of wave function. So you may ask, does this quantity make sense, right? If I made some gauge transformation and changed every wave function, right? I just redefine it and multiply it by a phase, right? Would this quantity change, right? And the answer is yes, it would change. But if you take the phase picked up over closed loop, such a quantity would be gauge invariant. Okay, so then this psi doesn't matter, right? So this tells you that quantity which is integral over some closed path with this called Berry phase is in fact a physically meaningful quantity, and this is a quantity which would, for example, if you have interference experiment where you're taking some path one in this space R, right? You're going this way, and let's say you're going the opposite way, and you want to know what is the relative phase picked up during such process. It will be given exactly by this Berry's phase, right? So it will enter, it will have a direct physical manifestation, for example, in any kind of interference you have. Do you have questions about this?
So the Berry's phase is the result of the
integral? Right, so Berry's phase effectively, so it's a function of the contour, right? And it's a phase picked up, this extra phase picked up, yes, when you're evolving, when you enclose this path. And also, of course, notice that that the time dependence dropped out, right? So it's really only the topology of the path that matters, not the rate with which you cover it. Okay, is this part clear? Yes, yes, of course. This is right, exactly. This is very crucial, right? So that's where we started, right? So we said, okay, let's assume that the evolution is very slow, so we can use a adiabatic theorem. Otherwise, if the evolution, and what does it mean? It means that effectively the rate with which you're moving must be less than the level spacing, because otherwise you can get excited to all higher levels, you will get some very complicated non-equilibrium state.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't work only for gap systems. So
for gap systems, I mean, no matter how slow you go, you always.
Right. This is a good point. So, I think this is, of course, it's easiest to think about it in the gap systems, right? But if you think about some process, right, where the electron does not change its energy but travels in some space, right? You can still Berry phase would still show up. Let's now consider the simplest and relevant to graphene example of spin or pseudo spin 1/2. Okay, so let's just carry out the following exercise. So let's find first let's find the eigenfunctions of our Dirac equation. Right, so you can so this is our Hamiltonian I delta k y delta k x plus delta plus I delta k y. You can see that you can pick the eigenfunctions in the following form. So you can pick them like that, where theta k. So its tangent is given by ratio of ky and kx. Okay. Now let's simply go ahead and assume that the momentum of our particle encircles the Dirac point. So imagine that I would adiabatically move it around the Dirac point, and let's ask: is there any non-trivial Berry phase associated with it? So first of all, we could pick this theta to be our parameter, okay? And so theta would play the role of R. And theta would change from 0 to 2 pi, right? And this quantity A of theta would be simply given by 1/2 e to the minus I theta 1 d d theta, right? D d theta, I would have just my theta 1. Now, d d theta only acts on the upper component of the spinner, but not on the lower one. So I get 1/2, right? And then when I integrate it, so prescription is that when I make a closed loop, I need to integrate this quantity from over the whole loop. So when I integrate it, right, so I get that gamma, because integral of 1/2 d theta 0 to 2 pi, this is pi, right? So which is actually important. It tells you that if a Dirac electron moves and somehow encircles the Dirac point, it is bound to change the sign of its wave function. Okay. So, and of course, this is, I'm sure some of you know that if you're thinking about just spin 1/2, when it encloses any solid angle, it corresponds to a phase which is given by the solid angle, actually divided by. So okay, if you enclose, actually it should be. So let's see. So if you enclose the whole sphere, right, which is 4 pi, it should be 2 pi, right? So it should be a solid angle over 2, effectively, right? So in this case, you traveled along the equator, right? So then you covered the area which is 2 pi on the sphere, right? So you need to divide it by 2. So now let's try to see what are the implications, right? And the let's go back to our story with the quantum corrections to transport, and let's see how it will be modified for the case of graphene. So let's imagine that that we slightly dope graphene, so that chemical potential is somewhere here, and let's see how this weak localization and return probability would change. So let's consider two different trajectories, so some scattering by impurities, and let's assume it to be slow, right? So let's assume that the disorder is can only scatter electrons by small angles, so the evolution of the momentum is slow, right? So this is one trajectory, and another trajectory is gonna be effectively going in reverse. So you start here, you go reverse, and then you come back here. And then remember we had an extra contribution coming from the interference between these two trajectories, which gave us which was like a1 times a2, a2 star, right? For the case of the usual electrons, their phases were exactly different, but for the case of Dirac electrons, it's not the case. So let's think what the pseudo spin does when we encircle this trajectory, right? So when we encircle the white trajectory, it just goes from let's say it's plus k here. It goes from plus k to minus k, so it does something like that along the equator, right? Now, if you think about the purple trajectory, you would see that in fact it does the same thing, but it goes with the opposite momentum, so it lives on the opposite side of this equator, right? So it goes like that, and now phases picked up during these two evolutions are different by exactly the Berry's phase. Okay, so you see that in fact, if you take Berry phase into account, this would become minus absolute value of A1, A2. So this tells you that because of Berry's phase, the interference becomes destructive. Okay, and instead of, remember before, due to interference between such trajectories, we got the enhancement of the return probability and decrease in the conductivity. So in the case of the Dirac electron, situation is exactly opposite, right? So there is destructive interference, so there is weak anti-localization, right? So this interference makes the electron spend more time away, right? So it would increase the conductivity slightly. Yeah.
So if you just did a one particle potential, would this show up in the ability to have a bound state?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This is a good point. You mean that the potential cannot trap such particles?
Well, but if you have, say, particles by free electrons, you know, with a K-squared type dispersion relation, then you might solve the problem for a bound state, find a bound state. Or I guess in two dimensions, I guess it's a little tricky because the bound states
Right. You can still solve it, yeah.
But you can still solve it. So you do it for free electrons, but then when you do it for graphene, you probably find that the same potential
does not trap. Yes, this is a very good point, and this is what we will very briefly discuss next.
Okay.
Right. So let's ask exactly this question. So what happens if we try to confine this electron? So let's imagine the simplest possible situation. Right. So let's take a barrier. Let's take a barrier, right, some V of X, and let's ask what is the probability to get transmitted through such a barrier. Once again, the fact that these Dirac electrons have pseudo spin turns out to be very important. Most importantly, it prohibits you from the backscattering. How can you see it? So what is the matrix structure of this potential? So it's effectively is just V of X times some unit matrix, right? Now the pseudo spins of the incoming and reflected waves are the following. So wave function of the incoming wave is e to the I to the k 1. Right, and this is, let's consider electrons which have momentum only in the x direction, right? So it's kx zero, then it's simply 1 1, right? But the reflected wave, right? So this is the pseudo spin which is pointing along x direction, as you can guess. A reflected wave would have a different wave function, right? Because it has kx being negative, so this would give you 1√2 -1, 1. Right? So this tells you that in order to get reflected, the electron must change the direction of its pseudo spin, and of course, because these two wave functions are orthogonal, scalar potential like that can never do it, right? It can never flip the pseudo spin because all the matrix elements, right? If you take matrix element between this V of X and incoming and outgoing waves, due to this pseudo spin conservation, it will always give you zero. So this guarantees that if you send a wave at the normal incidence, everything would get reflected. Everything would get transmitted, sorry, yeah. Yeah.
Could you explain why in a context that's better in the reflected wave instead of in the phase?
Why it has to have opposite?
Yeah, why the angle has to be opposite?
Right, so let's think about, so what was theta k? It was, right? So you start, so how does theta k behave, right? So it starts, it goes from zero to pi, right? So if I plot, so let me consider some circle in the momentum space, right? Then okay, here's the phase is zero, right? And otherwise it's just given by the argument, right? So you go, if you go from plus kx to minus kx, argument is pi. Okay, then this is just minus one, right? This is how we get it. Right, so this is quite an interesting result, right? It tells us that this quasiparticles tunnel in a very different manner, and one consequence is that it is impossible to confine them by any potential, right? So if you now make a quantum well, right? So that, let's say, V of X is minus V naught here and zero outside, you know that electrons can always escape, right? Because when they bounce off the wall, sometimes they would bounce at or close to the normal incidence, and they can simply go outside. Okay. So, and this is also, right, intuitively, this is very much agrees with this picture that there is no weak localization for the Dirac particles.
So let's see. So say you have your piece of graphene and you cut it for a white particle. Quasi particles are coming along, they get to the edge.
Mm-hmm. You mean where is the contradiction with this argument?
Yeah.
Right? Yes, so this is a very good question, and actually some of you guys should have asked it. Here I use an assumption which I never described, right? Here I always assume that the electron stays within one Dirac cone, right? So I assume that this potential is very, very smooth and changes at the scales which are much larger than the Lattice scale. Right, so only then I can write it in such a scalar form, right? Because effectively it means, what does it mean? It means that the potential is the same on the A and B, on the neighboring A and B sides, right? But it doesn't have to be the case, right? I could have some crazy potential, right, which is very abrupt, right, which changes on a later scale and physically terminating sheet of graphene is exactly an example of such potential, right? So if we just take a piece of graphene, right, it's not infinite, right? We can always just cut it, and that's what people do in the experiment as well, right? And then of course we are dealing with a very sharp potential which can change the momentum in the Brillouin zone by any amount. In particular, it can make the electron go between the two valleys, right? And then my pseudo spin conservation argument completely breaks down, because if you work it out and find the pseudo spin if you find the pseudo spin for the incoming electron in the first Dirac point and the pseudo spin for the reflected electron in the second Dirac point, you'll find that they're exactly the same. So, and well, and also, if you have if you have a potential which is no longer scalar, right, but which can have a term, let's say, which looks like sigma z, right, which is different on the different sublattices, right, then you're also allowed to flip the pseudospin. Okay, so all of this works as long as the potentials you're dealing with are smooth on the lattice scale. Right. Any questions about this part? All right, if not, then we will continue next week.
Okay, there is one more announcement.